I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Key Questions and Emerging Clinical Research Issues in the Management of Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia and Follicular Lymphoma. We're really excited tonight to be working with Dr. Jeff Sharman and Dr. Julie Vose. So here's where we're heading tonight. Really, these are some of the key clinical trials that have come out with these two diseases over the last couple years. But before I get started, I've got to ask Jeff about the acalabrutinib COVID thing. Really fascinating paper where you used acalabrutinib in patients with ARDS. Really fascinating paper. What kind of reaction are you getting so far, Jeff?
You know, I think it's encouraging that this is really sort of the first validation of a preclinical model that already existed prior to all this. There was some very robust science that had been done previously, and so we were able to bring this sort of into real life, into patients. And you know, I think that there's sufficient enthusiasm that most of the major BTK agents are really looking at how do we try to validate this at a phase three level as to whether or not this initial signal could be real.
And Julie, you were saying that you've been hearing about trials also with BTK inhibitors or a bunch of agents that are being used in oncology, being tested in COVID, IL-6 inhibitors, JAK inhibitors. Julie, any comment on this new approach?
Well, I think, you know, there's not a lot of information yet, but if clinical trials are available, I think we should all definitely try to participate in those and get our patients on those so we can see what the outcomes are.
Okay, well, let's start out. We're going to talk about CLL, and I want to really focus on the questions I'm hearing from docs in practice that they would like some input on in terms of practical clinical decision-making. That's what we're always oriented around with our group. And here are some of the questions, I think. And Jeff, you put together a talk and went through all the data, but here are some of the clinical questions we're hearing a lot of. Of course, selection of first-line therapy, probably the biggest topic in CLL. Also, BTK inhibitor differences, choosing a BTK inhibitor and the tolerability issues with the BTK. A very common question about the value of adding anti-CD20 to a BTK inhibitor. The issue of MRD evaluation and management in patients getting short-term therapy or limited therapy, venetoclax or obinutuzumab. Also, the question of how you sequence venetoclax and anti-CD20 antibodies, something, again, we hear a lot of questions about in general medical oncologists. And we're going to try to bring in some of the recent data sets that came out. Just picked a few slides out, Jeff, from your talk, just to sort of get warmed up before we get into these clinical issues. First, of course, we've seen a big change and a lot of people moving towards the use of this combination in CLL. Any comments on this data set here, the main data set, comparing that to chlorambucil obinutuzumab, Jeff?
Sure. So CLL14 was a upfront trial in patients who were older, sort of the less fit population, comparing a standard reference regimen of obinutuzumab chlorambucil to obinutuzumab venetoclax. And, you know, maybe not surprisingly, the novel combination outperformed the reference regimen. And I think the enthusiasm around this particular regimen is that it is a fixed duration therapy. And one of the topics that comes up quite frequently when we're talking to patients in the frontline setting is sort of fixed duration therapy versus indefinite therapy. And I'm sure we'll touch more on that later.
Any comments on this data set that was just presented at the EHA meeting last week, looking at this trial based on biomarkers, Jeff?
Yeah, so probably one of the most important biomarkers in CLL is the IGHV mutation status. I think people are increasingly familiar with 17P and maybe 11Q, but the IGHV mutation status is different than those, and I think provides additional information. And to me, that's a surrogate for the rate of growth. So somebody who has unmutated tends to grow faster than somebody who has mutated. And in the control arm, there's really no surprise. The patients who are mutated versus unmutated, that's a completely expected finding. What's interesting, and we're beginning to see, is now that we're sort of at the 3-year mark, and into the four-year mark, maybe we're starting to see a separation in the curve amongst those patients who have unmutated disease treated with obinutuzumab venetoclax. And that's something that I'm not quite yet ready to change my practice, but I'm going to continue to monitor as the data gets updated, because that's going to influence if that separation of curves becomes more profound. That's going to have a significant impact on whom I would offer this regimen to.
So before we get into some of the practical clinical decision making, Julie, just kind of curious how this regimen has kind of worked their way into your practice. So what kind of reaction you get from patients to it?
Yeah, so when patients have different options, and many of them do, I usually present the different options and the pros and the cons. And I think one thing that a lot of patients, and of course I point this out, is that it's a time-limited option and you don't have to take it indefinitely as you do with the BTK inhibitors. And that's a big selling point, especially for patients who have a big copay and can't afford to take something indefinitely.
So going back to the slides, Jeff, I picked out a few of the slides you presented in terms of BTK inhibitors. First, really the landmark E1912 paper. Anything you want to say about that, Jeff?
You know, ibrutinib was originally approved in the frontline setting after beating chlorambucil alone, which really wasn't the high watermark. But as all of us in the field have known, FCR has been sort of the most intensive frontline therapy regimen that could be offered during the cytotoxic era for our patients with CLL. And this was a study in which ibrutinib rituximab was compared to FCR, and ibrutinib rituximab came out on top. And so I think that should really impact the way we think about who might be appropriate for chemoimmunotherapy in the frontline status, because particularly after that study, you would have to say it's a very small group.
So I'm going to show you the results of a survey we just conducted over the last week with 50 general medical oncologists and community-based practice. And of course, one of the things we always like to check out is how they're managing their younger mutated patients. But just to go through a couple more of the slides before we kind of get into that, I really like this slide and your discussion of it, Jeff. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the adverse events that were seen in this trial, which was more younger patients.
Right. So we've seen in a number of publications that patients' tolerance of ibrutinib appears to diminish with age. And so the older you are, the more difficult ibrutinib is. And so this, in where the control arm is FCR, was specific to patients age 70 and younger. And I think the median age in the study was 65, if I recall correctly. So definitely a younger population who should tolerate ibrutinib the best. Amongst patients who started on ibrutinib, only 7% of them discontinued for progression or death. But roughly 3 out of 4 patients who stopped ibrutinib did so for reasons other than progression or death, so AEs, complications, or other, which I think is mostly a surrogate for AEs or complications or intolerance and so forth. And I think it just stands to point out that we really do have to coach our patients through oral therapy, and we can't just let them see in 3 months and see how you're doing.
So again, before we start to sort through the options, just to get back to more data. Another thing I wanted to bring out here is your ELEVATE trial. Jeff, can you comment on the acalabrutinib study? And then we'll kind of get into some of the differences in terms of side effects and toxicity.
Sure. So this is a frontline study, also in the older, more heavily comorbid condition patients. Median age in this study was 71, I believe. And it was a 3-arm study in which patients received either reference chlorambucil with obinutuzumab or acalabrutinib monotherapy or acalabrutinib in combination with obinutuzumab. And really not surprisingly, both of the BTK regimens clearly outperformed the reference regimen. The way this study was set up, it wasn't originally designed to test whether obinutuzumab yielded benefit over BTK monotherapy, but in sort of a post hoc analysis, we did see that there was a improved outcome for those patients who had the addition of the CD20 agent. we didn't calculate a p-value because it was a post hoc analysis. But either way, I think that BTK with or without obinutuzumab is another frontline treatment option, is now FDA approved for all patients in the frontline setting and relapse setting.
Any comments on the tolerability profile? You know, it's such a common issue in oncology where you have different therapies, but you don't have head-to-head comparison. I think there is a head-to-head comparison cooking of Acala versus ibrutinib. What was seen in the ELEVATE study, Jeff, in terms of toxicity?
Absolutely. So the one of the unique side effects of acalabrutinib is headache. This tends to occur within the first week of therapy. Tends to be mild, but it's, I think it's reported as high as 40% of patients experienced it. We generally counsel our patients, let them know ahead of time that it's coming, and that A, it tends to resolve pretty quickly. Good hydration, caffeine, ibuprofen or acetaminophen seems to get patients through it quite quickly. One of the other things we saw in this that was sort of interesting was that the way we scheduled it in this study was that the BTK was given for a month prior to the introduction of obinutuzumab, and that appeared to significantly reduce the infusion-related reactions of obinutuzumab relative to the chlorambucil obinutuzumab. We did see hypertension and bleeding and atrial fibrillation, but we think that those are fairly, you know, relatively low compared to prior data sets that we've seen. The atrial fibrillation, this particular study, the safety monitoring, the windows were very different for the control arm rather than the experimental arm because it was 30 days beyond the last treatment and for continuous therapy versus fixed duration therapy. So there was a skewing of increased length of observation in the experimental arms. So we think that those rates of atrial fibrillation and hypertension aren't too dissimilar to baseline, but as you pointed out, there is a head-to-head study of ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib that's cooking, and we should be able to see some of those direct comparisons rather than reaching across studies.
So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see that. You know, I'm curious about your comment of using obinutuzumab before acalabrutinib. I assume that's kind of a debulking thing. Is there a correlation between the infusion reaction with obinutuzumab and tumor bulk, Jeff?
You know, I think the infusion-related reactions in CLL with obinutuzumab are essentially universal. I guess I haven't seen many patients who don't have a reaction. I guess it would be hard to directly correlate to disease bulk in that way. And I think that initially the infusion reactions probably limited some of the uptake of the agent. But I think as more and more people have gotten comfortable with it, I think that that's faded away. You know, I think just knowing that it's going to be there and early interruption of the infusion is probably the most important takeaway from how to manage through it.
So, Julie, I'm just kind of curious now. We've got acalabrutinib out there for a while. And we can talk about some of the issues that Jeff just talked about and, you know, risk of atrial fibrillation, bleeding, et cetera. But I'm curious about quality of life, Julie. You hear about arthralgias and other problems that occur with these agents. Any sort of global clinical impression, Julie, quality life-wise between the two?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there's no head-to-head comparison, so this is all kind of personal experience. But and ibrutinib has been around longer, so there's probably more experience with that. But I would say definitely, as Jeff was saying, older patients typically have more complications or side effects from the ibrutinib. And the ones I run into pretty frequently in the older patient would be arthralgias, myalgias. I would say that's the top one, and that's a lot of the reasons patients of mine have discontinued it. Certainly, atrial fibrillation can happen, bleeding abnormalities can happen, but for the most part, patients tolerate that pretty well. Acalabrutinib, some patients don't like the twice a day, and definitely the headache is there, but it's transient usually. So I have to say I've had less patients discontinue the acalabrutinib for toxicities, but it's been around less time.
So Julie, when I saw Jeff's slide deck, the first thing I noticed with the next two slides that I'm going to show you, because they're really very thought-provoking, kind of getting into the art of oncology, and Jeff sticking his neck out a little bit about, you know, how he takes care of patients. And I just think it's fascinating to even talk about this way. So let's go through it, Jeff. This is sort of the art of CLL, so to speak. And you put down, you know, sort of characteristics of the patient clinically and how that affects your choice of first-line therapy, starting out with IGBH mutation status.
Yeah, so, you know, I would say until fairly recently, my approach was pretty formulaic, and it was IGH mutation status followed by FISH followed by patient sort of fitness status, and that would lead me to one over the other. And as we've had more agents, more approaches coming online, it's had to sort of evolve and become more nuanced and sort of break it into both disease characteristics and I think the next slide is probably patient characteristics. But you know, I come back to this IGHV mutated versus unmutated. Unmutated patients are not going to get a durable benefit out of chemoimmunotherapy. And so, you know, what we've seen in a lot of studies is that this is a test that's probably being underperformed and underutilized. But if I have a patient who has unmutated B-cell receptor, that's a patient where I'm universally going to try a targeted agent over chemoimmunotherapy. For mutated, I think you have a lot more options, and I think that we'll get to that with some of the information in the next slide. But I think that so I sort of say consider the secondary disease characteristics. For 17p, what we've seen in follow-up of the CLL14 study is that those patients with 17p or TP53 don't do... Their improvement on obinutuzumab venetoclax is not as robust as for those patients who get BTK inhibitors. So if I have a 17P, I'm going to favor a BTK over obinutuzumab venetoclax. And because of the tumor lysis considerations, somebody who comes in with very bulky disease, I'm probably going to favor a BTK over obinutuzumab venetoclax.
Before you go to the next slide, I just want to get some feedback from Julie on this, because I was struck by I hadn't really thought about the issue of bulky disease. But Julie, any comments on this slide to start with, particularly, for example, the preference for BTK over VEN-G for 17P and bulky disease patients? Any comments on that?
Well, I think that's there are options, and I always talk about options with the patients and options with looking at the data. And some of the newer data, as Jeff pointed out, is showing some of the differences. So I think if we have further follow-up on these studies, you know, it may help us in that decision.
So Jeff, you mentioned the patient characteristics as affecting, you know, we know that you're going to individualize this to an individual, but what I really appreciate is you're putting your thinking out there on a slide like this, and maybe you can talk about it.
Yeah, and you know, just to emphasize, these are sort of general leanings. I don't think any of these are hard and fast rules by any means. And as Dr. Vose points out, I think every patient's going to be individual. But you know, we talked about the disease characteristics, and there's the patient characteristics. It's cross-trial comparisons, all the limitations. It seems to me maybe we're seeing a little bit less hypertension with acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib. Chronic kidney disease, the tumor lysis issue comes up again. So, you know, for a patient who's got a creatinine of 1.6, it's going to give me pause to recommend obinutuzumab venetoclax. For those patients who have compliance concerns, you know, I think you could either argue for a once a day therapy such as ibrutinib rather than a twice a day acalabrutinib. But if I am going to use acalabrutinib, I would oftentimes include obinutuzumab with it, because it sort of gives me some sort of safety net for that patient that I know they're getting therapy. For patients who are on proton pump inhibitors, there's no question that ibrutinib gets absorbed better, or I should say acalabrutinib is more disproportionately affected by proton pump inhibitors. So if the patient is really wedded to their proton pump inhibitor, ibrutinib over acalabrutinib. If somebody has ibrutinib intolerance, I try acalabrutinib before I abandon the drug class. You know, I think these are not all the same. And so if somebody has intolerance of one, I would oftentimes try the other before moving on from BTK inhibitors. And if somebody's on, you know, heavy anticoagulation or direct oral anticoagulant, I think that obinutuzumab venetoclax really has some structural advantages in that regard, because we don't see the same bleeding characteristics. Again, these are all just sort of leanings rather than hard and fast rules, but it's some of the things I'm thinking about when I'm doing an initial consult or approaching a therapeutic decision.
So, Julie, any comments on these thoughts? Also, including, I see a lot of people when patients are having gluten intolerance going to Venn-G, but I'm just kind of curious, Julie, any thoughts about these sort of thoughts?
No, I totally agree with that. The one I think I sort of have underestimated is the patients that are on the proton pump inhibitors. That's unfortunately pretty common. And I just had a patient recently that we wanted to try acalabrutinib on, and he just could not be without his proton pump inhibitor. So we had to change drugs. So it's a real problem.
So we're going to fire a few through a few clinical scenarios and see what the audience thinks and see what you all think. So for the audience, here's we're going to put up a question for you to answer. Here's a clinical situation. I have a young patient with IGVH mutated disease, what we're just talking about before, no DEL17P or T53, which, you know, really those three assays to me, from what I hear from you all, are really what determines to a great extent, a choice of therapy. I'm going to show you, we'll see how the, I see there's a fair amount of FCR in the audience, which is kind of interesting. And when we asked these general medical oncologists, we also saw not an inconsequential amount of FCR, but three quarters of the, but more than half of the audience chose novel agents. Jeff, one of the issues that comes out here, and you can see it here in these answers, is the question of whether you add anti-CD20 to BTK. Any comments?
Yeah, so there were two very large, well-conducted studies that looked at the value of adding rituximab to ibrutinib, and both of them firmly answered no, that there's no value of adding rituximab to ibrutinib. However, not all CD20s are the same, nor are all BTK agents the same. And so the question then becomes, does obinutuzumab make sense, or does rituximab to acalabrutinib, or even novel CD20s such as ublituximab? So in general, I don't think there's any one situation where it's a hard and fast yes that you need to add a CD20. I think what called into question was that Elevate treatment naive study in which obinutuzumab was added to acalabrutinib, and those curves did separate. I think you can see a difference. It can add, but it also comes with some toxicity. There's, of course, the infusion reaction. There's time in the infusion chair. In this current COVID world, I don't know that I want to be in an infusion chair if I don't need to be. There's the issue of cost. There's the issue of greater neutropenia, maybe some risk of tumor lysis. So the benefit does come with a cost. And you know, I think some of that it's going to come about when I'm reading a patient, you know, trying to see what their preferences are, whether or not they're going to want to add that or not.
So, you know, it's interesting too, this particular, you know, it's only 50 oncologists, you know, not necessarily a pure indication of what's going on. There seemed like less Venn-G in this group, but you look at the audience here tonight, a lot more Venn-G in this situation. But Julie, I'm also curious about this situation, which is a younger patient with unmutated disease, and we'll let the audience sort of mull that one over. But Julie, what about the, we were talking about the patient with mutated disease, the very young patient. You mentioned to us that I think in the last couple of days you saw a 51-year-old patient with mutated disease. Does that change, you know, if you get a patient that young, do you sort of view them differently than somebody who say 60?
Well, you know, age is what you look at it, and also have to look at the other issues such as creatinine clearance and other healthcare issues when you're deciding those things. But I do offer those patients FCR and tell them what the data is, long-term data from MD Anderson showing that they're, you know, maybe a plateau on the curve, and we think maybe some of those patients could potentially be cured or at least in remission for a very long time. So I think you just have to be upfront with the data and the toxicity, of course.
It's interesting, you know, in our poll here, we had 8% of people saying FCR. Here, we have even more than that, 19-20%. Jeff, you were saying that you think that maybe IGVH is underutilized. You think there are lots of patients not getting that assay?
Yeah, we've seen that in registry data that it's sort of almost dreadfully underutilized. So in this patient who has unmutated IGHV, that's just not a patient where I could accept the toxicity of FCR because we know that the long-term outcome from both CLL8 as well as CLL10, you know, a typical patient with unmutated CLL is going to get sort of four to six years out of FCR. And while that seems good, it also comes with a treatment-related mortality that in prospective clinical trials might be as high as, say, 3 to 5%. So FCR is a very intensive regimen, and I reserve it exclusively for those young, ultra-fit patients with mutated IGHV who, after considering the risks and benefits, want to go for that long-term disease control. Because we know that if you get at least 8 years, if you get 8 years out of FCR, very few progressions happen after that. And in the mutated population, that might be over half of such patients.
So we'll look at a couple other scenarios we presented in our survey. We talked earlier, and you had in your slide there in terms of Del17P preferring BTK, and I think that's what we're seeing here, although there are a number of people saying VEN-G. Here's another, let's just go right to the answer in the sake of time. Julie, what about the patient who has a history of atrial fibrillation on anticoagulation? We said that Del17P, the audience favors venetoclax, but a fair number, actually almost as many, say acalabrutinib. Any thoughts in general, Julie, in terms of patients with atrial fib and or anticoagulation?
Yeah, in that kind of patient, I probably would also favor VEN-G as well. But I do think trying a different BTK inhibitor is an option, but I probably would put that as a secondary option just because of the data that we know about.
So I want to talk a little bit also about relapse disease and get into another issue that I hear a lot of confusion about. And here's the Murano study. Maybe, Jeff, you can comment on this. But what I really want to get into is the issue of the sequencing of venetoclax and CD20, because it's a little confusing in terms of the indication, the trials, and how it was done with the trials. Could you kind of review that, Jeff, and then kind of talk about what you actually do right now?
Yeah, this is a situation where the label was obviously created by the trials, but the trials were informed by maybe what was understood at the time, which venetoclax was coming along very quickly, but then in the very early development, there were a couple deaths from tumor lysis. And so the development subsequently proceeded very, very cautiously and appropriately. So in the Murano study, which is rituximab venetoclax versus bendamustine rituximab, that particular study had the venetoclax begin a 5-week ramp up prior to the addition of rituximab. And that was because it wasn't known if the rituximab might potentiate the tumor lysis. In practice, I don't know that it really matters. I think you can do it any way that makes most sense. I kind of approach the situation fairly flexibly, and quite often we'll even use the rituximab before the venetoclax to just sort of get rid of the lymphocytosis if I think the rituximab is going to do much. But that's just a situation where the trial is more an artifact of what the science was when the study was created.
So another issue that comes up, Julie, is MRD. This was measured in both the upfront and recurrent trial, and I want Jeff to comment on this data looking at the Murano trial from that perspective. But I'm just kind of curious right now, Julie, in the upfront setting, when you have someone who gets VEN-G and gets out to the end of the treatment at a year, and do you get MRD status, and does it change what you do?
Yeah, so I think in the academic setting, that's probably being used a bit more than in the community practice setting. And then there's a difference of what technique is being used. Is it, flow, which is less sensitive than the tests were used in this study? Is it PCR? You know, what's the test that's being done? So I would say in general practice, it's really not being used a huge amount.
So, Jeff, any comments about these data that came out in the Murano study on MRD?
You know, I think the punchline is if your MRD is positive, you're going to get less duration of benefit. There hasn't been any studies that tell us what to do with that information, and I think that's what's most challenging. I do use MRD, but I'm... I'm using it in a way that I don't necessarily know to be as data-driven, which is that for my patients who are on venetoclax, many of them have already failed a BTK inhibitor just because, you know, I've had the BTK inhibitors in my clinic for a long time. And so for a patient who is MRD positive at the end of 2 years, that's a patient where I have to be thinking about what I'm going to do next for them. And if they're already failed a BTK and they've already failed a venetoclax, I need to have a backup option. So I'm using MRD in that setting to have an early look and know what I need to do with that patient moving forward.
Any comments on these data that were just presented at EHA looking at MRD over time in the Murano study, Jeff?
Yeah, so they looked at this sequentially, which was nice. And effectively, if you're MRD positive at the end of 2 years, you're probably already going up. So it doesn't look like continued therapy is likely to make more patients MRD negative. So, you know, this is where the data gives us some insight into what direction these patients are going if they're MRD positive. And I think this tells us that, look, if you're MRD positive, you've already had a BTK inhibitor, you have to have a plan in place pretty quickly.
So one other thing I was going to ask, I'm just going to kind of skip through these in terms of new trial concepts that you're looking forward to see in CLL. Jeff, maybe you can pick out a couple that you're most excited about.
GLOW will be very exciting because that will likely lead to the FDA approval of an all-oral targeted regimen, ibrutinib, venetoclax versus chlorambucil, obinutuzumab. Whether we'll hear about that at ASH or a later meeting, not entirely clear. CLL13 will look at venetoclax, obinutuzumab in the younger fit population as opposed to the older population where it was already done. And then probably the last study and maybe one of the most significant is the ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib, which will really give us some fascinating look at the direct head-to-head side effect profile of these agents.
So I want to just end with a couple of cases that you went through in some detail in the talk, but just briefly, sort of what the teaching point was of these two cases. First, the 66-year-old man with extensive comorbidities. It's like, which one do you pick to focus on? But maybe you can comment on this, Jeff.
Yeah, so this is actually a case that was presented to me just recently of a 66-year-old gentleman with CLL who met criteria for treatment, but it was really more about navigating his comorbidities to arrive at a treatment decision. So this guy was hepatitis B core antibody positive, which makes me a little bit nervous about really any of the agents, but particularly CD20 agents. Patient had a history of myocardial infarction and had paroxysmal atrial fibrillation as well as some chronic kidney disease. He had a dilated left atria, which, you know, tells us that the atrial fibrillation is probably going to be more problematic in that individual. He's on some direct oral anticoagulants with apixaban and clopidogrel, but also diltiazem, important for its CYP3A4 interaction, and omeprazole regarding BTK absorption. Met criteria for treatment, but didn't have bulky nodes. And the question is, okay, ibrutinib, you have some concerns regarding the atrial fibrillation, hypertension. Acalabrutinib, you're concerned about the use of omeprazole. For both BTK agents, you're worried a little bit about the clopidogrel and apixaban. For venetoclax, you're worried about the diltiazem because the CYP3A4 will increase the exposure there. And with the creatinine clearance of 1.6, you're worried about the tumor lysis. So there's sort of a reason to avoid every possible treatment option in this individual. And he did get obinutuzumab followed by ramp up of venetoclax. But I'll say even just from the obinutuzumab alone, the patient had some hyperkalemia that needed additional fluids and so forth. So a very precarious patient, but highlights a number of interesting teaching points.
Wow. So he had borderline tumor lysis just from obinutuzumab. Fascinating. How about the 69-year-old woman, Jeff? What was the issue there?
So this is a gal who came into my clinic after a lymph node biopsy that said SLL, but hadn't had any blood work done. And then when we got a CBC on her after the visit, her white count was 500,000, which was alarming. She was treated sort of in the pre-novel agent era, got FCR, but only 3 years later had rapid progression, started on ibrutinib, but really had two major contraindications to continuing therapy. A, she had severe stomatitis and just couldn't eat. I mean, she had very bad stomatitis. She also had ANC of zero, and we were, you know, trying to support it with growth factors, but really had some significant neutropenia. And I would say both those can happen, but in her case, were more severe than we typically see. So at the time, venetoclax rituximab had just been approved. And so she went on that regimen and did well. But at the end of 2 years, she was MRD positive. And as we discussed previously, that's a patient I'm concerned about. So I followed her, and over 3 to 4 sequential flow cytometries, I saw that her MRD rate was increasing. And in her, I put her on acalabrutinib just recently. That wasn't an option to me back then. It is now. And so far, she's done great on it. But you know, we have to come up with a solution for this gal who's really otherwise young and quite robust as to what we're going to do next for her.
So Julie, I know Jeff and I talked about this case for like 15 minutes in the video, but just to boil it down, a couple of things I was curious about. The mucositis and neutropenia with ibrutinib. Julie, have you seen that?
Well, definitely the neutropenia. That's pretty common. The mucositis, really not so much. I haven't really run into that as a major issue. That one is puzzling.
No. Any thoughts about Jeff's interesting strategy of switching to acalabrutinib because of increasing MRD levels, Julie?
Well, I guess I'll be anxious to see what happens. I don't know that that's very scientifically driven, but be anxious to see what the outcome is.
Yeah, so, Neil, the strategy there, and look, the indications for therapy haven't changed, right? I mean, we treat patients for rapid rise in white blood cell count, symptomatic bulky adenopathy, but if we have a patient who has failed a BTK and failed a BCL2 and has a very, as this woman has had sort of an explosive relapse in the past, that may be why I'm jumping in earlier. And you know, I agree with Julie's point that maybe that's premature, but in this particular patient, I feel comfortable with the recommendation.
Makes sense to me. Julie, good question from the audience in the chat room. In a patient with G6PD deficiency who can't receive RAS-BRCase, could you discuss management of hyperuricemia and how high can you go in allopurinol dosing?
Yeah, that's a really big problem. And definitely allopurinol, you can push the envelope as far as the dosing and frequency of it. But if the patient runs into trouble, then you're, you know, back to kind of old-fashioned things of fluid and diuresis and watching the patient very carefully. So that is an occasional problem that you run into.
So we're going to move on now and talk about follicular lymphoma. And there are several, again, practical clinical questions we want to address here. Some of the data sets that we're going to be considering. Basically, we're going to talk about first, second, and third line therapy and new data sets. And Julie, the first patient that you presented, and we'll get to that in a minute, was a patient who got bendamustine obinutuzumab. Can you talk a little bit about the gallium study and sort of how it affected the way you take care of patients, Julie?
Sure. So the gallium study was a very large international study and published a couple years ago now in New England Journal. But previously untreated follicular lymphoma patients, grade 1 to 3A, advanced stage disease, and they were randomized to our chemo, either R-CHOP, RCVP, or Benda, or G-chemo with the same chemotherapy. And it was physician's choice on the chemo option. And then they had maintenance after that. So I think the kind of punchline of this study is that if you look at the patients for progression-free survival, patients that were randomized to the obinutuzumab-containing chemotherapy had an improved progression-free survival as compared to patients that were in the rituximab-containing chemotherapy. Overall survival, however, was not different, as we see in many follicular lymphoma studies. But I think this is an important first step in showing a difference. And there has been a little bit more uptake, I think, of obinutuzumab based upon this paper with respect to patients that are being treated upfront with chemoimmunotherapy.
It's always interesting to try to predict how people respond to new data sets. When I saw this data, I figured, you know, everybody was going to do it. And that kind of didn't quite happen exactly. One other piece of data I want to just bring out on the table before I ask Jeff for his thoughts, Julie, was this subsequent analysis. We know that relapse within 24 months has a poor prognosis. And they actually looked at the gallium study and found that there were fewer relapses. Any comments on that in the first 24 months, Julie?
Yeah, I think this is important data because we know from many other data sets that patients that relapse within 2 years really have a much worse outcome. And in fact, nowadays, if that's a younger patient, we usually recommend transplant in those patients if they've relapsed within 24 months. So if you could reduce that relapse rate by giving them an obinutuzumab-based regimen, then that's probably a benefit. With longer follow-up, it may be a difference in outcomes as well.
So, Jeff, what's your take on this, and what's your sense about what's happening in clinical practice and your practice?
Yeah, I think that it's very difficult to execute a study in frontline follicular lymphoma because, you know, you look at those Kaplan-Meier curves measured over so many years, it takes a long time to show a benefit. You know, if you model the PFS benefit, sort of the median, you have to project out a ways, but it may be a gain of 24 plus, maybe in as much as 36 months PFS benefit. I have adopted obinutuzumab, but particularly some caution in the combination with bendamustine, where in the studies there were a number of infectious complications, infectious deaths that happened. I have not embraced the obinutuzumab maintenance as strongly in that population, but I do feel like, you know, obinutuzumab was also compared head-to-head with R-CHOP in large cell lymphoma, and that was a negative study. And I think had that study read out as positive, you would see a wholesale sort of substitution of obinutuzumab for rituximab. But that study was negative, and it didn't get a label in large cell lymphoma. So I think the uptake has been a little bit more muted.
So I just want to I want to bring up one thing in relationship to that. The patients that were in the obinutuzumab arm did have increased they did have increased problems with infection, but they didn't actually use routine prophylaxis like we normally do. And so I think that's a little bit of the difference that was seen in that trial.
So speaking of data sets, it's always interesting to see how people would respond to. I was very interested in how people responded to the relevance trial comparing R-squared lenalidomide rituximab to our chemo. Julie, you talked about this in your talk. Can you comment a little bit on what was seen there and how it sort of got translated into practice?
Sure.
And also in terms of the relapse, we'll look at the relapse as well, but let's start out with relevance.
Yeah, so previously untreated follicular, a very large, robust trial, very well designed, over 500 patients in each arm of the trial. So our chemo, again, this kind of the same types of regimens with rituximab maintenance versus R-squared. You can see the different blocks there, and then a little bit of rituximab maintenance in those arms. And CR was the primary endpoint.
Before you go on, I'm just kind of curious in terms of the schedule here. I have heard, you know, it's pretty prolonged. You know, it's over 2.5 years, although it was the same length and because they did the maintenance. But I have heard, Julie, people talk about using abbreviated versions. Bruce Chesson, I think, uses it for about a year. I think it's being looked at in different in trials with different durations. Do you think that, you know, it's important to follow the exact schedule, or can it be varied a little bit, Julie?
Yeah, I would say most commonly patients are probably getting the R-squared for a year and not for the 18 months as in this trial. And some of that, of course, is related to tolerance, cost issues, other things, but probably I see most commonly a year being used. Yeah.
So, any comments on the data, Julie? You know, I think people agree it looks, from an efficacy point of view, pretty similar. Hard to see a difference.
Right. So, you know, I think there were course, hoping for an improvement, but what basically the data shows is not a lot of difference as far as R chemo versus R squared. So I guess you could take that two ways. One, to say that R squared's not better, but it's also not worse. So that in certain patients, that definitely is an option to consider.
You know, I was, you know, not personally thinking necessarily be superior. I was thinking it would be less toxic and that people would prefer it because of the lack of chemotherapy. Can you talk, though, because that's where it kind of has gotten a little bit surprising. I think the perception in terms of toxicity has been that maybe it's not that much different, at least from the point of view of a lot of oncologists. I'll ask Jeff in a second what he thinks about it. But Julie, how have you thought this through? What do you think about the comparison in terms of quality of life and toxicity, and how are you integrating this into your practice? We'll look at, you know, R squared is very effective in the second line also. Any comments, Julie, on what's been seen in terms of toxicity and what you do in your practice?
Yeah, so I think that R squared is normally a fairly tolerant regimen. However, you have to look at the dosing. And so there's pretty frequent dose reductions in kind of real life that you do have to use because you do have cytopenias. Also, there's probably more cutaneous reactions with that, some more GI issues. So it's not necessarily less toxic. It may be different toxic.
So Jeff, any thoughts about this? Again, you know, I was surprised at the issues that some of the lymphoma investigators brought up in terms of their concerns or difficulties using long-term lenalidomide. And yet, you know, we have the general medical oncologist sitting in the audience in the old days when we had an audience going, oh, we get this thing for years in myeloma, not, you know, not that big of a deal. How do you process all this, Jeff?
Yeah, well, one key thing was the relevant study was a frontline study that was powered and primary endpoint was supposed to show superiority. And having failed to do that, I mean, it really showed very much an equivalent outcome, which is, for the reasons you cited, I think fairly compelling. But the study was designed for superiority, so it did not get a label in this setting. And so I do think that reimbursement and insurance considerations are very real in this setting. And I think it's limited use in the frontline setting considerably because it's approved in the relapsed refractory setting, whereas they were hoping that this would be sort of all comers. So I still see it mostly being utilized in the relapsed refractory setting where it got its label, you know, fairly recently. From a side effect perspective, I do think it's reasonably well tolerated, but as Dr. Vos pointed out, with the cytopenias, recognizing that reducing the dose may be necessary.
So let's see what our audience is thinking. We have a case here of a 78-year-old patient with symptomatic disease who requires treatment. So I'm just kind of curious how you all would likely manage a patient like this. Also curious, Jeff, in terms of the issue of single agent anti-CD20 therapy, where that fits in and whether you ever use obinutuzumab alone as a single agent in FL, Jeff?
I haven't. You know, obinutuzumab is approved in the frontline setting with chemoimmunotherapy. So I haven't used it as monotherapy either in the frontline or relapse setting. There was a study that directly compared obinutuzumab to rituximab that showed a higher response rate but a similar PFS. And maybe it wasn't a super well-designed study because it was only four dosages. So in answer to your question, I haven't used obinutuzumab a lot. You know, there's a lot of information maybe missing in this particular case, a 78-year-old who requires treatment. Would you consider rituximab monotherapy? 78-year-olds can be either, you know, they could be chemoimmunotherapy candidates or they could be barely rituximab candidates. And so understanding their performance status and, you know, how vigorous they are would play a role. It's hard for me to get terribly excited about rituximab monotherapy in a patient with bulky adenopathy. So maybe this is a patient where I might use obinutuzumab with CVP. But if they're robust and they've got good functional status, we'd consider bendamustine.
Again, Julie, how would you be thinking it through? It looks like the audience, the most common answers are benda. But, you know, a fair number of people saying, oh, benda. And you can see not too many people saying R squared, which is often, I think, use second line. Julie, how would you be thinking through a case like this with a 78-year-old patient?
Yeah. I think, and similar to what Jeff was discussing, that you have to look at the comorbidities of the patient. What's their creatinine clearance? Other comorbidities that aren't apparent in the case. Probably your standard 78-year-old that needs treatment for follicular lymphoma, has good organ function. Probably BR or BO are the two that I use the most commonly.
So, Julie, we were talking about the fact that R squared is commonly used in the second line setting based on the AUGMENT trial. Can you comment on that study and what they saw there?
Right. So this is relapsed follicular, and there was also a few marginal zone patients in here. And just a pretty straight randomization to Rituxan with placebo or R-squared. And 5-year follow-up looking at outcomes and secondary malignancies and things like that. And I think this really is an important trial in that it did show that R-squared was superior in progression-free survival to rituximab placebo arm, and is definitely something that can be utilized in this patient population and situation fairly successfully. It does have side effects, as we all know, as we talked about earlier. Cytopenia is biggest one, and you do have to dose reduce over time in some patients.
So just I'm going to kind of skip this poll and get to the issue of PI3 kinase inhibitors. There's only 3 improved in FL. Amazing being in oncology nowadays. Julie, can you just briefly summarize, you know, sort of the difference between these 3 and also kind of in general how you choose is often used as maybe you can tell us in third line?
Sure. So 3 agents currently approved. Idelalisib, which was the first one, is oral BID dosing. Copanlisib IV, and then duvelisib oral and BID dosing. You can see the indications there. They're all for follicular and 2 of them for CLL/SLL. Toxicity profile is a little bit different. Idelalisib, first in class, and so a lot of this kind of wasn't known at that point. So a lot of the initial trials did have cytopenia, some diarrhea, hepatotoxicity, infectious complications, and then I think a lot's been learned since then about the side effects of this and how to try to prevent these as well. Duvelisib is similar to that, but does have some decrease in some of the toxicities as we've learned over time. Copanlisib has a little bit different side effect profile. It can cause some hyperglycemia and can also cause some additional types of cytopenias, but is IV for those patients who really can't take oral drugs. You know, the outcome, it does have some complete responses, although low. Most of them are partial responses. And for certain patients, it can have a prolonged progression-free survival. So depending on the patient population, some of the characteristics, it can be very, very good for those individual patients.
Jeff, any comment again on selection between the 3? What's your experience?
You know, I think that the molecular structure of idelalisib and duvelisib are really so overlapping that the it's hard for me to differentiate those two, and I think their molecular structure and their clinical behavior are also very similar. You know, that's with the different route of administration and the different side effect profile of copanlisib, that's where I'm going to sort of look at somebody's sort of comorbid conditions coming into it. You know, somebody who might already have diabetes or has issues with hypertension, I might favor the oral. For somebody who's got GI issues to begin with, I might favor the IV version. You know, with idelalisib and duvelisib, really important to monitor liver function tests early on. This is not ibrutinib. You can't just put somebody on this and see them a couple months later. You need to be checking their LFTs regularly. And then the diarrhea is can be very significant. And you know, I think, I don't know of another drug class that can have diarrhea that compares. And so have to have early interruption of the oral agents at the first sign of diarrhea.
How about checkpoint inhibitors?
Okay, fine.
I think actually, well, I guess I bring that up because I guess the thinking is it is an immune colitis, correct?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I, of course, more in the liquid tumors, haven't used those as much. But I think it's just important to recognize that the diarrhea can be significant. And generally, treatment is early interruption of the oral and use of enteric steroids or even IV steroids, as you point out, because it appears to be inflammatory.
So, Julia, somebody was mentioning to me today, they think there's been more drug approvals during the COVID pandemic, but maybe it's just coincidence. I don't know. But anyhow, last week we saw another agent getting approved for FL. I don't even want to begin to try to pronounce it. I just call it TASI, but maybe you can do a better job on that. But it really interesting in terms of what it is actually approved with a molecular test, a companion diagnostic. Any comments, yep. Julie?
Yep. So tazemetostat. So this has been in clinical trials for quite a number of years. But interestingly, that the EZH2 mutation test, which is by Roche as a companion diagnostic. So the patients who benefit the most from this drug in the clinical trials were those that did have that mutation. So that's where it has a higher response rate, although it is also approved for wild type with respect to the multiply recurrent follicular patients where they have no or very few options. The response rate is lower in that group, but there were a few patients that responded and had long-term duration of remission even in that group.
So Jeff, I was really shocked when I found that only 10% of patients have this mutation. Pretty strange in a way to have it approved that way. How do you see this playing out in practice? Are you going to use it in the non-mutated patients?
Yeah, we actually created a protocol in our network to just screen patients for the mutation. I think we screened 80 patients and enrolled six. So I think our numbers were even a little bit less. But it's a lot of effort to find the patients. I was interested to see that the approval included both mutated and unmutated. In my own mind, I think as more agents become available, I think we're on the verge of a number of drugs coming online. I'm really excited to see the bispecifics and how those take place. And maybe we'll even see CAR-T in this setting. So I think that some of these drug classes will be moved more towards end of the line type settings.
So just to finish out with the two cases that Julie discussed in her presentation, so Julie, 60-year-old man, basically, who gets bendamustine and obinutuzumab. We were talking about that. Seems like he's done pretty well. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with him?
Yeah, so this patient was 60. He was otherwise in really pretty good health and had very extensive disease and cytopenias. So patients like this, I have been more recently treating with bendamustine and obinutuzumab, and he had a good response to that and CR. And then maintenance as per the trial we talked about earlier. One thing I do want to point out is you do have to absolutely have these patients on prophylaxis, so acyclovir and Bactrim, and we continue those for 6 months after the bendamustine is finished because that problem remains afterwards. And he's done well. He's in CR for a year and has had no problems. So I think in select patients is a good option.
How did he do with the obinutuzumab in terms of infusion reaction?
You know, as Jeff was saying earlier, almost everybody has an infusion reaction with the first dose, especially if they have bulky disease. So it's pretty common and we're used to that now. And that's why the first dose is split into two parts.
So how about your other patient? You have a 72-year-old lady and we were talking about R-squared as second line therapy. What happened with her?
So yeah, a patient who was treated quite a few years ago, but she got bendamustine rituximab, first line and rituximab maintenance, did well for quite a while. And then about 5 years later, relapsed and was given rituximab lenalidomide R-squared. And she's done very well and remains in remission. So a lot of these patients, you do have to reduce the dose on the lenalidomide. It's not uncommon that I find that you have to reduce dose over time for tolerance for cytopenias, but she's remained in remission and done well.
Any quality of life issues with the R-squared? Any diarrhea, GI problems?
I've not in this particular patient, but I do find that some patients do have diarrhea issues, and that's common in the myeloma patients as well. So you often do have to either reduce the dose or sometimes we give it in alternative days, or sometimes you have to use other means, Imodium or whatever, to help the diarrhea. but it is an occasional problem.
So I want to thank Julie and Jeff so much for joining us today. Thank you all who participated.